Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
For about 3.5 years, there's been this case working its way through Utah's courts. In 2022, the League of Women Voters and Mormon Women for Ethical Government sued the legislature for not following the rules when redrawing Utah's congressional districts. Now, since statehood, redrawing the districts has been the legislature's responsibility. It's a duty assigned to them by the state constitution. But then came Proposition 4 in 2018. This is a ballot initiative that voters narrowly approved to remove partisanship and gerrymandering from the process and to create this independent commission to redraw the maps. The problem, according to these groups, is that lawmakers ignored the commission's maps and approved their own. Well, last week, we got a ruling. Third District Judge Diana Gibson threw out the legislature's map and ordered them to draw a new one that follows the principles of Prop 4. This week, we spoke with Elizabeth Rasmussen. She's the executive director of Better Boundaries. It's the group behind the push for independent redistricting. And when all of this began, Rasmussen says she was a college student who found herself drawn into the fight for fair maps.
The process for getting on the ballot in and of itself is very, very challenging in Utah. The signature thresholds are very high. At the time, I was just an undergrad student in Utah, and I did my little part to submit some signatures. And then in 2018, we had a very incredible win for 3 ballot initiatives, actually. Expansion of Medicaid, medical marijuana, and Proposition 4. It empowered voters. It allowed voters to have a say. But in 2021, the legislature, they passed a bill which eliminated the core of what Proposition 4 is and passed their own gerrymandered map. And you could really see the gerrymander in the congressional districts where they split Salt Lake County into all 4 districts. It was disappointing. They didn't want any of their ability to draw these districts taken away. And that's the incredible thing about Proposition 4. It actually didn't take away power from the legislature. It still had them as an integral part of the process. It just made it so they had to follow these standards, which are pretty straightforward in that you keep communities together. You make sure votes count equally. And honestly, after being frustrated, it moved to a place of motivation to see, okay, what can we do? What's next? And we had some incredible individuals who said that this wasn't okay, and they brought a lawsuit to the legislature saying what you did was unconstitutional, and the battle went from the ballot box to the court system. Anytime you enter in such a high-profile case, it's going to be pretty tense. I mean, we went through appeals, went through delay tactics on the legislature's side. But the Utah Supreme Court in 2024, July 11th, they affirmed that our Utah Constitution gives people the right to reform their government through the ballot initiative process. Because of that win, we are able to build on that momentum and say, okay, voters, we have rights. And let's see how that applies to Proposition 4. So we had received a message from the 3rd District Court on the Friday before the ruling came out saying that it would come out following week. And so, of course, we were very excited. We had prepped for this for years at this point. So I waited with our team that Monday. Time ticked by. And finally, at 7 p.m., we get this incredible ruling forwarded to us from the legal team that stated that right to reform your government that the Utah Supreme Court had, it applies to Proposition 4 here. And what the Utah legislature did was unconstitutional. It was illegal. And because of that, our current congressional map is out of compliance and it's time for us to get a new one. We expected, hopefully, at least a partial win, meaning the court would say that what the legislature did was wrong and illegal, but we didn't know how far the court would go. And seeing that complete victory for the people of Utah was just incredible to witness. And so we're pretty optimistic about the fact that this is moving forward and that we could get new congressional maps for 2026. And so what this will look like is that the legislature has the time to submit their altered map that complies with Proposition 4 standards. And at the end of it, we're going to have to see if the legislature will comply with this or if we'll have to go to the courts to have them choose one of the maps that complies. So right now, it's really on the legislature. It's their opportunity to show that they can follow this law. For right now, I do know that the state isn't represented the way that it actually is made up. But I do see us having more competition, more meaningful conversation on policy because of that competition. And I only see positives from these new maps that we could have.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah's lawmakers reacted to Judge Gibson's ruling in the way you'd expect, with comments ranging from disappointment to outrage. Legislative leaders said the judge had elevated an ordinary statute above the state constitution. They called it judicial overreach. On Tuesday, Judge Gibson denied lawmakers' request to stay the case. And now they say they're stuck trying to figure out how to redraw the maps in a way that complies with Proposition 4 while still protecting their constitutional authority to do it. The story is still unfolding, or as State Senator Scott Sandel put it to us, it's a moving target. Sandel is a Republican member of the state Senate. He was co-chair of the legislature's redistricting commission when lawmakers redrew the boundaries in 2021. Now, one of the most crucial questions in this case is whose job is it to draw those boundaries? And Sandel told us when you look at the state constitution, it's pretty clear.
Article 9, Section 1 tells us that the legislature shall divide into districts. So it's definitely the legislature's responsibility.
All right. Well, let's read that language out. I think it's interesting. So as you said, here it is. The legislature shall divide the state into congressional, legislative, and other districts accordingly. That seems clear. That's your job. But then there's the other part that reads this way. Let me read that. All political power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and their equal protection and benefit. And here's a key part here. And they have the right to alter or reform their government as the public welfare may require. Now, those seem like the two competing ideas. One that says, hey, it's the legislature's job. They shall divide the state. But then the other one says, but citizens have the right to alter and reform or reform their government. So how do you square those two?
Well, clearly, they're different sections of our Constitution, of our state Constitution. So what the plaintiffs did was they didn't like the outcome of the map, the congressional map. And so they dove into another section of the Constitution, went to the Supreme Court, all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, the citizens have the ability to alter or reform their government. And this proposition is that. And so now, even in that ruling, we're a little wondering how the Supreme Court has created super laws that can't be changed by the legislature. So anyway, that's kind of the basics, I think, of what happened and where we've gone. And now we're down to the legislature shall redistrict. The judge says that and has agreed that it's the legislature's responsibility. And so the legislature is agreeing to say, okay, we will draw a different congressional map.
So I'm looking at a statement from the Senate president and the House speaker, and it said the legislature will defend its constitutional authority, but also move forward with redrawing the congressional map. How are you thinking about doing both of those things? You think you can defend your authority and still redraw the map? What that sounds like is you're game to compromise here. Is that right?
Nope. I think to defend our obligation, we have to draw a map. If we don't draw a map, then the judge indicated in her ruling that she would take a map from somewhere else and somehow make that the map. And I think that would be us setting aside our responsibility. We want to take the reins completely. And because we're charged with doing it, and the judge says we need a new map, our constitutional duty is to divide the state.
But the judge also ordered you to pass these new maps using the standards of Prop 4. Is that how you understand it?
Yeah, that's how I understand it.
Okay.
Which is very interesting because Proposition 4 is a process, not an outcome. And so what we followed was the process, which was the law of Senate Bill 200. We followed that process. 200 was mostly an encapsulation of what Proposition 4 was. So if we go back and we look at and we delineate what the requirements around Prop 4 are, the process, I think we'll follow that. First of all, except the fact that the judge has said that she's not going to reconvene an independent redistricting commission, which was in Prop 4. But the basic guidelines are we're going to try to follow geographic boundaries, make the districts compact. There's about seven things in there that are process driven, and we'll go back now and do it one more time.
What's wrong with the independent commission's maps?
What was wrong with the independent? Well,
as you saw, like, why not just adopt their maps?
Well, they were tasked with giving us three maps. Mm-hmm. One of them actually was against their own rules, which was curious. They sent us a map that was developed by a citizen of the state of Utah on a tool that includes political data. Now, that hasn't gotten much press, but one of those three congressional maps was developed on what's called Dave's redistricting tool, submitted to the independent commission. The independent commission substituted what would have been their green map, the map that Rob Bishop was working on. They substituted that map and sent that map to us. So now we have a map that defies all consciousness of their rules in one degree. Secondly, the other two maps that they sent simply did not encapsulate one of the biggest things that as a redistricting committee, we focused on, and that was that each congressional district should have a piece of rural and a piece of urban in it, basically because our natural resources that we depend on in our urban areas come off of federal land. Our citizens recreate on federal lands, and if we don't have a congressperson in whose district incorporates rural and urban, I think we really missed the mark.
Senator, I wanted to get your reaction. We hear this occasionally. I'm sure you hear it. It probably drives you crazy. But there's this idea that lawmakers just don't like ballot initiatives because it takes away their power to have the final say. How do you react to that as a lawmaker?
A ballot initiative is troubling in the fact that when it becomes law, it has not been debated in the public side. There's been no serious debate, and you can't change what those words, the language in that initiative are as you go through the process. The other laws that we enact all have committee hearings. They have a debate among legislatures. They have amendments. They have changes. They can rewrite the whole draft as you go along before it's passed. When you have an initiative, it starts out as an idea, it goes on the ballot, and then it's passed. I think that's a really poor way to make a law.
But it expresses the will of the people. They've voted on it. I mean, that surely you want to take that into account when you're thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. I think that's fine. And when a ballot initiative passes, I think you do assume that it's the will of the people. You'll find on all of the ballot initiatives that were passed in 2018, even by the standards of those who proposed the initiative, there were some problems in the way it was those initiatives were drafted. That's why Medicaid expansion people came to the table. That's why medical marijuana came to the table. And quite honestly, that's why Better Boundaries came to the table and said, okay, you see what the will of the people is here, but we've got these tweaks we need to make. We've got this and this and this that we need to do. And in doing so, then the legislature takes that into account and passes all three of them with, quite honestly, everybody at the table.
I wanted to get you to react to what seems to be a kind of ironic twist in the story. I mean, initially, it seems Judge Gibson was on your side, that this is your role to redraw the boundaries as you see fit. But then lawmakers, of course, proposed Amendment D, and then the state Supreme Court got involved. They blocked it, and in this ruling against it, the court clarified citizens have this constitutional right to reform their own government. That's where Judge Gibson seemed to, I don't know, it's hard to know, but that seemed to provide the clarity that Judge Gibson needed to throw out the maps and say that this was a two-part process. What do you make of that, I guess?
It definitely was a reversal. But you may recall that the Supreme Court initially, the case that Judge Gibson sent to this, actually from her, that went to the Supreme Court, The Supreme Court didn't rule on redistricting.
Right.
The plaintiffs actually changed the narrative. And I was surprised as I watched that. They didn't ask the Supreme Court to rule on the redistricting issue. They chose this other path that initiatives are the will of the people and you have the right to alter or reform government through the will of the people. Once the Supreme Court ruled on that, then this ruling came back to Judge Gibson, and she used that to say, aha, Proposition 4 needs to be followed. And there again, now I have a little bit of a dilemma, because if we're following Proposition 4, the judge has determined that we're only going to follow parts of Proposition 4.
Does that give you hope, the fact that the state Supreme Court initially didn't throw out the maps, for example? Does that give you hope that the Supreme Court might rule in your favor if you appeal to the court?
I don't know if it's a hope, but I do know that we will defend as a legislature what we believe is the constitutional right of the legislature to draw maps. The legislature will defend that right, because that's how we read the Constitution. Apart from the alter and reform part, the Constitution definitely says, and Judge Gibson last Friday agreed that the legislature has the obligation to do this, which was funny because in her ruling, she asked the plaintiffs to deliver maps to her. So again, the water's pretty muddied.
Well, she said the court is not drawing. I'm reading from her statement. This court is not drawing a map. It's the legislature's responsibility to make sure there's a lawful congressional one in place for the election. This is the legislature's job.
Yeah.
But the question
that
has
was
come
Friday.
Up. Right, that was Friday.
Friday.
Right.
Did you read her ruling that came out late Monday? That's basically said that the legislature had 30 days to adopt a map, and that she would accept maps from the plaintiffs.
Yeah.
So that's
throwing you off.
Like, well, how do you square that?
Yeah, right.
If it's the legislator's duty to do it, and the plaintiffs, according to the judge, get to submit a map, how do I square that? And how do I square that with Proposition 4?
Your attorney said last week, I think we can either have new maps from the 2026 election, or we can have maps that fully comply with all of Prop 4, but I don't know that we can have both. It sounds like you're going to try to make this work.
Well, I agree with, we can't reconvene an independent commission, which is clearly in Prop 4, and do that in 30 days.
Yeah.
If we're going to follow the timeline of 10 days of public comment and we're the clock's ticking. We still haven't been completely given the guidelines from the judge on what our factors are going to be developing the map. So I do believe it's correct. You can't have both. You can't do this in what was then 30 days and follow all of Prop 4. You're going to have to be guided in which parts of Prop 4 are apparently the most important.
With all those constraints that you've got, is there time to do this, pull this off?
Well, yeah, there'll be time, but it'll be a lot of work. I spent hundreds of hours as the co-chair during 6 months trying to develop maps. Now, granted, that had the additional three maps involved in it. This is one map, but we're going to do our best, and we're going to take our responsibility seriously. And quite honestly, if that means that we're going to put our committee back together and we're going to dig in and try to accumulate all these factors, we can do it. But we can't do everything that's in Prop 4 in 30 days.
Senator Sandel, thank you very much for the time.
Well, I appreciate it.
That's State Senator Scott Sandel. He's a rancher and farmer in Tremonton. He represents District 1. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing what happens now that a judge has thrown out Utah's congressional maps. The judge ruled lawmakers undermined the power of voters in the state constitution and that new congressional districts are going to have to be redrawn. And there's a deadline looming. So we wanted to talk about who gets to decide what Utah's districts look like, lawmakers or voters or both. And if it's both, how does that work? And then there's the question of whether a change could shift the political balance in the state. We asked Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune to join us, as he often does for these kinds of things. We also had with us University of Utah political science professor Matthew Burbank and Holly Richardson. She's the editor of the news site Utah Policy. She's a columnist for the Deseret News. And she told us she thinks this story is a big deal.
Part of it is the part of the broader conversation that we're seeing nationally, I think, with do you redraw maps mid-cycle so that you can favor one party over another, right? I think that's part of it, even though it's not actually related to this effort, but it just the timing works out so that it's now become part of the broader conversation. But it's a big deal also just in Utah because it's really looking at how much input does the citizenry actually have into the lawmaking process and especially redistricting in this case?
Is that the big question for you?
Yes. I think the interesting part of this from my perspective is that what would have been an entirely Utah story, right, about a Supreme Court decision and about a judge and about the maps within the state has become part of this broader national conversation because of what's going on, which again is in and of itself is very unusual, right? We have a circumstance where the president is saying, I need states to redistrict so that I can keep control of the House of Representatives.
And we're not close to a census.
That's right. Yeah. And we're not following a census. Yeah. I just need them redistricted. So that's surprising. And again, nobody in Utah was planning on this becoming a story, right? But we are now part of that broader story.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you had President Trump tweeting about the redrawing districts in Utah on your bingo card, I think you'd done pretty well. It's kind of wild how it's taken on that national perspective, that national context, but also from just the local perspective. I mean, this has been an ongoing fight now for 7+ years, and it seems to be coming to a head, within the next few weeks.
Utah Senator Mike Lee sent this as an ex post. He wrote this: legislative districts are supposed to be drawn by state legislatures, not elected and in air quotes, independent commissions designed to give Democrats an edge. Who's with me? That was his post. All right. Take apart the who's with me this part. Is he right about the other stuff, that it's supposed to be drawn by legislatures, not anyone else? I mean, because it gets to the big question here, which is who's supposed to be doing this? Matthew Bowman, start.
Well, again, historically in Utah, it's always been the state legislature has done. And again, there's there's constitutional language that indicates it's the legislature who does that.
It's always been pretty clear.
It's always been pretty clear up until very recently.
Yeah.
But again, it's not true that that's a blanket rule in every state, right? Because in fact, other states have gone to commissions for a variety of reasons. California has one. Various other states have one. And most often they've done that in an effort – not always successful, but in an effort to try to take some of the partisan politics out of map drawing. And so – and again, sometimes they're, you know, commissions of retired judges. Sometimes they're independent commissions of, you know, multi-partisan groups of people. So states have done that differently, but it's entirely reasonable for a state to do something like that, right? It does not say that it has to be the state legislature who draws these maps. You know, within the state of Utah, the state legislature wants to draw those maps because they ultimately want to be responsible for what those lines look like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the judge reiterated that point in the hearing just last week where she said, I'm not going to draw a map. It's the legislator's job to draw the map. But it goes to a larger question of how they draw the maps. What are going to be the rules of the game that they play? And if the public has a right to pass ballot initiatives that create rules on that or create an independent redistricting commission, then those are the rules. I mean, constitutionally, the public still has the right to pass ballot initiatives as they did in 2018. So yes, the legislature ultimately is the one that draws the maps. But because of this ballot initiative, they have to draw maps that don't have a partisan benefit or disadvantage another party. They have to draw maps that are compact, have compact districts, are contiguous, respect communities of interest, respect geographic or, you know, city, county, municipality lines. Now, yes, they get to draw the maps. The legislature shall draw the maps according to the Utah Constitution, but they have to do it within those constraints that the public and that the law has put on them.
And I think that's where you get the crux of the discussion here, or the arguments on both sides, right? So you have a judge who says, yes, the legislature does need to draw the maps. However, they are not the sole ones who have the ability to have input. And so when the Utah citizenry passed Prop 4 in 2018, and not by a lot, but it still passed, they set those boundaries, like Robert just said, right, that you have to fit maps within these parameters. Well, the Utah legislature didn't want to do that, and they tossed out, basically, Prop 4. They didn't follow the guidelines there. And that's why you got this lawsuit, right, that has taken a while, honestly, to wend its way through the courts.
Let me just talk about that ironic twist here, because I want to set that as a baseline for people to understand. At first, the question of who's in charge of drawing congressional boundaries, as we were saying, seemed clear. Even the judge, even Judge Gibson, seemed to concede the point that according to the state constitution, lawmakers, as you said, Robert, shall draw the congressional boundaries. She conceded that point. But then things changed. And I think it would be fair to say that it backfired on Utah lawmakers. Can we talk about this twist so we can understand how we got to this point where we're deciding who actually is in charge?
So I think one of the things to note there is, again, we had in 2018 – three initiatives pass, right? And the legislature set about rewriting each one of them, right? And in two of those cases,
they didn't like any of them.
They didn't like any of them. And in two of those cases, they basically were well within their rights to do so, right? Because they were treated as legislation. And of course, if they're treated as legislation, what that says is the state legislature can always come along and change them. And that's the approach the state legislature took, and they took that to all three of them ultimately. And in particular, what happened in the case of the Better Boundaries Initiative, that was a circumstance in which the state legislature just wrote a new law essentially saying, yes, you can have this commission, but it's simply going to be advisory. We draw the lines. We do not have to follow, you know, your procedures at all that were passed in this initiative. And in doing that, that ultimately is once – that decision was taken to Judge Gibson's court. She largely agreed that indeed the state legislature had the power. That decision got appealed to the Supreme Court. It's when the Supreme Court made that decision that said, in essence, No, when there's a ballot initiative that reforms or alters government, that has to be treated differently by the state legislature. You can't just rewrite it willy-nilly. And so that really set up this circumstance that we're in now is, again, how are we going to square these two things, right? The fact that we've got a ballot initiative that says one thing and we've got the state legislature, which has a long track record of saying we draw the lines and here's how we're going to do it.
So if the Supreme Court said – clarified, voters had the right to alter and reform government through the ballot process, but it's up to the legislature to draw the congressional ballot. Those seem like conflicting ideas. And it seems like, how do you make that work if one has the power to do it, but one also has the power to reform and alter? So how do those mix? How do you see those things mixing? Because they seem conflicting right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right, is where is that line? And, you know, I think it's interesting where you have a legislature – and I used to be a member of the legislature. But when you have a legislature that says, in essence, we don't need to listen to anything that the people of the state tell us. We know better. And that's what I feel like the messaging has been, right, on this issue and on others as well. You don't know as much. I remember trying to use that argument once when I was the legislator. And I actually had somebody call me on the carpet and tell me that I was basically being arrogant and condescending and that what I needed to do was actually listen to people who disagreed and understand their point of view. And I've never forgotten that. But I see sometimes, at least it feels like, the Utah legislature says to the people of Utah, we don't care what you think. We know what's best for you, whether it's drawing a map or something else.
So how did they do it, lawmakers? So they said, no, we're not going to rely on an independent commission to do this despite what Utah voters said in Proposition 4. We're going to go ahead and draw them anyway. What principles did they apply and what did those maps look like? And I don't know if you've looked at them. How can you compare – how do you compare them, the ones that lawmakers came up with the ones that independent commissioners came up with?
Well, one thing to note is they're not wildly different, right? It's not like you're looking at two different worlds or something, right? And in part, that's because it's a relatively square state with four congressional districts, so you can only be so creative in how you do that.
You know, plus, it's a very red state, right?
Plus, it's a very red state. Yes. So again, Republicans are not going to be redistricted out of office or anything like that, right? That's just not going to happen. So I think what you saw with that, again, the kind of difference was, right, that the state legislature essentially made this argument that what we want to do is make sure that each congressional district has a rural area and an urban area in it. And the way that they chose to do that was to take Salt Lake County and divide it up into four different areas, mm-hmm. and then largely leave the rural areas contiguous, going off in different areas across the state. Again, that's not a terrible way of doing things. There's a reason for doing it that way.
And are you suggesting they did that and they were motivated surely by fairness?
No. What I'm suggesting is it also happened to work out that the one kind of community of interest that they decided to divide up, right, was Salt Lake County.
Well, that's what I want to ask about.
Where there's a Democratic stronghold. Right?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So what did motivate – I guess here are some questions. What are they afraid of? It's a very red state. There's plenty of Republicans. How would it alter the balance of power if, as they used to do, they sort of granted a more progressive district, a blue district? The district number two was always that. Now, it wasn't always Democratic, but it often was. So, Robert, what do you make of that?
Right. I think after the 2011 cycle, they kind of learned a lesson because they did draw a district that was only about 12 points to a Republican advantage, and Ben McAdams ended up winning that. And so they like, okay, aha, we can do.
Mia Love was in between.
Yeah, right. They're like, okay, well, we can do better. And so they came back and drew maps that are about 25% Republican advantage across the board. If you look at the voter results from the 2020 election in Salt Lake County, you can see the blue areas and mm-hmm. the lines go straight directly through those blue areas and end up meeting roughly in Mill Creek, right? So they split that blue vote into four distinctive districts, diluting it with the Republican vote across the rest of the state and the rural parts of the state, and ended up with four solidly Republican seats. And there hasn't been a Democrat who's had a whiff of winning one of those seats since that happened.
Okay, so there's that. But what about the principle of communities of interest? I don't think you can ever tease out politics from the motives here, but just at least work through the argument with me between having a community of interest that is Salt Lake County or that particular region, right? Urban area, long the Wasatch Front, whatever, versus a little bit of urban, a little bit of rural as it is now. Like what's the give and take in those principles as you understand it?
Well, one of the issues, right, is you've got to have the numbers relatively even, right? And so the population center is along the Wasatch Front. There's no way that you can draw a map that really encapsulates just the Democratic areas, right? The numbers wouldn't match. And you can't have one that's just rural because the numbers don't work because there's not enough population. So that's one of the issues.
So that's just circumstance, not even principle.
And not only that, if you do try to draw a rural district, it's going to be massive.
Right.
It makes it very hard.
The entire, like this giant U around the entire state, right? So I live down in Utah County. And if you remember when Jason Chaffetz ran the first time in 2008, he did not live in the district that really was incorporated by almost all of Utah County because the split there was in Alpine, right? The very northernmost part of Utah County. And his argument was, I'm part of this Utah County community, right? And I don't think he was wrong about that. So that's the problem that you always end up with is you are going to split some communities just by the nature of the process.
Holly Richardson, she's the editor of Utah Policy, also co-host of the KSL radio program called Inside Sources. Matthew Burbank is a political science professor at the University of Utah, and Robert Gerke is a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, 3rd District Judge Diana Gibson ruled on a case that's been in the court for years. In 2022, the League of Women Voters and Mormon Women for Ethical Government sued the legislature, and they argued lawmakers had ignored a voter initiative called Prop 4, which created this independent commission to draw new maps for Congress and the legislature and the state school board. But lawmakers ignored the maps and approved their own. So last week, Judge Gibson struck down the congressional map, and she ordered lawmakers to draw a new one. So today in the program, we've been talking about what the ruling will mean and what it could change. We have with us Holly Richardson. She's the editor of Utah Policy. Matthew Burbank is a political science professor at the University of Utah. And Robert Gerke is with the Salt Lake Tribune. Donald Trump has weighed in a social media post. He said, how did such a wonderful Republican state like Utah, which I won in every election, end up with so many radical left judges? Let's talk about the one radical left judge he seems to be talking about, and that is the judge who made the ruling here, Diana Gibson. What do we know about Diana Gibson?
We know that she was appointed by a Republican governor and confirmed unanimously by a Republican-dominated Senate. She was appointed by Gary Herbert, who told some Politico reporters that it was laughable, I might be paraphrasing, that she was considered liberal. Also, one thing to realize is that with the 3rd District Court, there are 17 judges in that system, and they do not pick which cases get assigned to them. They are randomly assigned. So she was not out there.
If she got to pick, she probably wouldn't have picked this one.
Right, exactly. She was not out there sending it to me, right? I mean, yeah, exactly what you said. If she had that option, she probably would have said, no, thank you.
And just to build on that again, her initial take on this lawsuit was
– in deference to the lawmakers.
This is the state legislature's job, right? And that got appealed to the Supreme Court. And then things changed. There's no indication at all that this is about judicial activism.
And people have made the same complaint about the Utah Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. And to Holly's point, they were all appointed by governors. They were all confirmed by a Republican Senate. And by and large, hadn't had much controversy until the last couple of years. And it's really created this blowback against the judiciary, I think, that's been really fascinating to watch, where there's been discussions about packing the court with additional justices, having judges elected, raising the threshold for retentions, mm-hmm. things like that, where they're really clearly trying to get a little bit of a leash on some of the judicial independence.
Robert, you said you if you were a member of the judiciary, you might wonder if lawmakers are gunning for you in this upcoming session?
I would be absolutely 100% positive that lawmakers would be gunning for them in the upcoming election. And there's already, you know, talk of things like combining judicial districts to, you know, kind of dilute the liberal urban areas of Salt Lake County with some of the Utah County, things like that. You know, the appointment of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, not a major thing really, but a bill that Governor Cox vetoed at the end of last session.
Said he didn't want the
he
job.
Said he didn't want it. He didn't ask for it. He doesn't want it. He has no interest in it. They appear that poised to pass that again, and he seems to be on board with it now because there's not a reappointment anymore of the Chief Justice. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of blowback, and it's going to be in big ways and small. I mean, last session, their funding was pretty minuscule. They had some requests for buildings and things like that. They got almost nothing. And I think it's that friction between and we should talk about the friction. I mean, I think, as I said, the legislature doesn't like to be told no. They're not used to that. And the governor is rarely does it. The public has done it a few times, and the judiciary has done it many times in the last couple of years. And I think that really grates on the legislature, grinds their gears. And so they're going to make sure that they get those radical judges under control somehow.
Well, you've called it, Robert, the vortex of power, this idea of there being a kind of power creep that's developing. What about the rest of you? Holly or Professor Burbank, have you noticed
Yes. And I think the blowback will be also towards citizens, and I think towards groups that promote some of these. So I think certainly you're going to see some effort to restrict citizens' ability to bring citizens' initiatives. I think you may see additional restraints or restrictions on groups like Better Boundaries, for example, or the public employees unions, to use a different example, right, to make it harder for them to participate as well in this process. Yes, the power creep is real, and I think you see it on a national level, and I think it has translated to the state level as well. That once you have some sense of power, you don't want to give that up. And even though there's co-equal branches of government that are supposed to have checks and balances, to your point, Robert, they don't like to be checked.
There was so much enthusiasm among progressives and Democrats in the state when this ruling came down. And you would see sort of social media responses like, finally, we have a shot, or things are going to be different. We're going to change the balance of power in some way. We're headed purple, possibly. What do you make of that reaction? Because I guess the underlying question here is, even if Better Boundaries or an independent commission does change get the opportunity to redraw the boundaries, would much really change? What do you make of all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we think about the congressional districts anyway, really all we're talking about is whether we have four solidly Republican districts or we have three solidly Republican districts and another one that's potentially competitive. That's really what's at stake here. So again, the best kind of Democrats can hope for is that they win a congressional race and then they have one Democrat along with three Republicans, right? Because again, there's not really any likely chance that we're going to end up with some other balance. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would, I think, feel nice for some of those people to feel like, oh, I got to go vote for a Democrat and the Democrat actually run a congressional district. But again, is it going to change the balance of power in the state? I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you heard from the Democratic Party and some of the progressives is that they've lived in a state where they have 38% of the electorate voted for Joe Biden, voted for Kamala Harris, and those people have not had a representative in Congress since Ben McAdams. Mm-hmm. And so they feel like maybe there's a chance, like Professor Burbank says, that you know, three Republican districts and one that could be toss-up could lean slightly Democratic. But at least it's a chance, right? And it's something that they haven't felt for quite some time.
Yeah, I don't think it shifts the balance of power either. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I think you may have a more competitive district that may go back and forth, right? You may end up with a purple district, but that'll depend on voters. It'll depend on the rest of the national discussion, right? And it depends on the candidates. Sometimes the candidates just can't garner the votes.
I think it's probably also worth noting that this only applies to the congressional districts. It doesn't apply to the legislative districts or the school board seats. But you could envision a scenario where, based on the precedent that's been set with this, that those are also maybe ripe to be challenged for 2028.
What did you make of Judge Gibson's timing for all of this? She gave lawmakers, at least initially, until September 24th. I think she said she'll be flexible on that deadline. But she didn't leave them much time. Do we know why?
Well, she didn't leave them much time because it took her a long, long time to get the ruling out. I mean, it was 7 months since the last arguments in this case. I think the hardest part of this ruling was probably, and I'm speculating here, but was probably trying to figure out the best remedy for this. The lieutenant governor's office says they have to have districts drawn by November 1st so people can start filing by January 1st. They could change that filing deadline because it was always in March before, but I'm not sure they're inclined to do that to create the breathing room. So yeah, she's set up a very tight time frame, and if the legislature doesn't comply with it, she's going to be put in a position where she has to decide if she's going to pick a map submitted by the plaintiffs, which again puts her in a pretty difficult spot.
Okay, but, Judge Gibson said last Friday, she said, we're kind of in uncharted territory. Mm-hmm. There's really not a roadmap for what we do next, which is really interesting. And she said, Robert, I think you mentioned this earlier. She said, this court recognizes the separation of powers. I understand it's not the court's job. It's the legislature's job to redraw these boundaries. So what happens to the maps drawn up by the independent commission? What happens to the right of voters to reform and alter government that the state Supreme Court said they had in this process? Are citizens at all going to be involved in that process? Or is it, in fact, as the judge said, just the legislature's job? Where do citizens come in?
So a couple of things. So one of them is with Prop 4, at least as I understand it, when it passed, it said the legislature does not have to accept any of these maps. They can accept one or more than one or zero, right? But that they were bound by the other constraints that Robert already mentioned, right? That you have communities of interest and that you don't look at partisan strength when you're redrawing those maps, those things. But I think what happens is for the public to participate, there will be a time for public comment. Now, does that necessarily mean the maps are going to change because of public comment? It does not mean that, right? Right now, there's 10 days, but the judge also indicated that if both attorneys or attorneys for both sides agreed, she could shorten that time for public comment. But that's probably going to be the only way the public gets to participate this time. Although she did say, if anybody in the public wants to submit a map, feel free, you can do that.
That's right. In the entire public process in the 2020 recycling cycle, and it's in 2021, all the public comment happened before there was a map on the table from the legislature. And so it was more about people expressing their desires to see, you know, rural, urban, or to not have partisan gerrymandering. It was all of that. Hmm. The legislative map came out on a Friday and it was signed into law on Wednesday. And so, you know, there wasn't a public process to speak of in terms of nitty gritty input on the legislative maps then. So they can do this. But there was all that process in 2021 where the public was involved and submitted maps, and the Independent Redistricting Commission had a lot of public involvement and it submitted maps. We're awash in maps. No shortage of maps right now.
So why would lawmakers even challenge this ruling to the state Supreme Court? Sounds like they could potentially get their way anyway. Or am I wrong about that?
Well, they still have to submit a map that complies with Proposition 4. The judge was very clear. Proposition
4
is the
law in Utah,
and they don't want to do that. And they don't want to have those constraints. Okay. They don't want to be handcuffed the way that the judge is going to require them presumably to be. And they don't want to see their power eroded by the courts. I mean, this is a constitutional right that they feel that they need to protect vigorously and intend to do that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is ideally what their outcome would be. They appeal this to the Supreme Court. They point out that there's this constitutional language. You've come up with this ruling, and the Supreme Court says, okay, we were wrong. We're going back to the old way, and it'll just be the state legislature that draws these things. That would be their preferred outcome because, again, where they want to be is they want to be the ones in charge of drawing these lines.
So what happens if when they take it? They're going to take it to the state Supreme Court. What are their chances of prevailing?
I think that the first thing, and I'm not an attorney, but I think the first thing they're trying for is a stay. They want to delay this past the 2026 midterms for sure, right? And if they can delay it until the next census, great. But the first thing they're looking for is to get a pause on this so that they don't have to comply by the November 1st deadline that Lieutenant Governor's office say they need.
This may be why President Trump's paying attention to Utah.
Because of the midterms. Yes, I mean, there's a seven-seat Republican majority in the House right now with four vacancies. And the party in power, Professor Burbank knows this much better than I do, but the party in power almost always loses. And right now it's the special elections we've had recently for House seats have generally been very favorable to Democrats. And so Republicans are desperate to keep power in the House because if they lose that, A, the agenda gets stalled because bills that pass the Senate won't pass the House. B, you start a whole investigations power, you hand that over to Democrats. They're going to have a field day with that. And C, there's the prospect of impeachment on the table. The House originates impeachment proceedings. We've had a president who was twice impeached by a Democratic House. Could he be three or four or five if Democrats take control? I don't think he wants to find that out.
Robert Gerke, he's a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Holly Richardson is the editor of the news website Utah Policy, also co-host of the KSL radio program Inside Sources. And we had Matthew Burbank with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Utah. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.